Welcome to the Honeycomb Podcast, the podcast all about New Zealand food and drink and the people that make it happen. I'm Asher Boot, your host and owner of the ramen shop Hillside, Daisies and Bowl. Taking care of all the technical stuff is producer Steve Cochran of Rockwell Productions. In this episode, we speak to Hayden McMillan about his career so far, work-life balance and partnering into a Wellington institution. Hey man, thanks for joining us.
No worries. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, look forward to having we chat. Maybe give us a little bit of background. You know, where did you grow up? What got you into food and cooking and a little bit of that journey?
I grew up in West Auckland. Yeah, which is, it's funny. I think West Auckland gives you a sort of a good background of a lot of, you know, different ambitions and not, and you see a lot of things. Well, I'd say I was good at school at what I was interested in.
Yeah.
I think like a lot of chefs, they try to, you know, fit a square peg in a round hole. But yeah, I sort of didn't do too well at school. I was pretty lucky. I got into AUT super early and, well, you know, to study to be a chef. And I don't know what it was that, I'd never grandma that used to cook these amazing recipes and I'd sit under the table and have all the scraps, and mum wasn't a big, you know, cook. Or, you know, my family, you know, they were just normal three veg, one meat type of family. Yeah. So I don't know what it was. It was either a pilot or a chef.
Okay.
And then I was
too different.
Yeah, I know, I was too naughty to be a pilot, yeah. So and too tall apparently. So I was pretty young. I got into AUT to study to be a chef, and I enjoyed it. Like I went from being naughty at school, sort of not focused. You know, my favorite subjects were interval and lunchtime, to, you know, 90%. It was just something I was super interested in.
Mm.
So I went to AUT, got my qualifications, and I'd sort of work part-time in kitchens around there.
Yeah.
And then I got a job at a place called Iguazu, which is in Parnell, and it was sort of like a big 300-seat restaurant. Yeah. And it was pretty, I wouldn't say it was famous, but it was an institution in Parnell at the time. And I ended up getting fired from there. You know, they were like, I think at the time they were like $3,000 a week down on their bev stock take. You know, like I said, I got fired for just drinking a little bit of do you remember the old scallop dish with the mustard and brandy cream sauce?
I
was on the fry section. All the chefs have finished and they're all like sitting around and I'm there still cooking because the bar's open. And I just made myself a little Coke and brandy to, you know, feel a part of the team. And then, they made an example of me. But, you know, it's crazy because without being fired from there, I never would have applied for my next job, which was at Vinny's.
Mm.
And Vinny's at the time was like an institution. It was one of the best restaurants in New Zealand and had been for 10 years. And I didn't really know that.
Mm.
I went there for an interview, sort of just lied my way through. Mike Choi, who was the head chef at the moment, he was Michael Meredith's sous chef. And then Michael Meredith went to open the Grove.
Yeah.
And then Mike was the head chef there and he's, you know, do you know how to make brulee? And I was like, yeah. And I sort of just lied my way through it. But it wasn't until I got into that kitchen, which was, you know, it was super fine dining for New Zealand, that I was just like, wow, I've never seen food like that before.
It's really interesting how that happens. I mean, I've heard people speak about Michelin restaurants. I had no idea what a Michelin restaurant really was until I went over there and I worked. And that was an eye, you know, that was a real sort of shock to the system, but it really realized what it could be as well. You know, it was just a whole new game.
Yeah.
And you do hear that story. And I think, you know, talking about sort of New Zealand cuisine and as it's developed, it's probably a bit clearer now, but, you know, 15 years ago, or I'm not sure when you're speaking about, but I had never thought about the best restaurants in the country or anything like that. Mm. I was a chef. I was learning to work. I was learning to just do a job.
Yeah.
And then you learn over time about these extra sort of levels and steps and
when I saw that I remember thinking I could make a career out of this. I think once you get it to a certain level in restaurants, you see a certain different style of food and you see a different success in the chefs, or, you know, the owners, the restaurateurs. You know, a lot of them are, you know, head chefs and owners. You know, after Vinny's I went to the French Cafe and, you know, they had won best restaurant in New Zealand. I think they've got to be one of the most awarded restaurants New Zealand's ever had. And going there was just like, I had that mentality that if you want to be the best, then you have to work for the best people. So I'd sort of picked the people that I wanted to learn and work with. And then I sort of just ticked that off. So did the French Cafe for 2 years, went down to Hooker Lodge for a year, which was basically like a holiday. It was going from, you know, 90-hour weeks to you know, like a 3 o'clock break, you know, an hour for staff meal. It was fun though. It was good to sort of get out of Auckland at the time. And then I went back to Auckland to be the sous chef at Meredith's. And I thought Mike was just he's the most innovative chef of that era.
Mm.
So I did 2 years there, which was, it was awesome. Like I always thought the French cafe taught me how to work, like just to push on. It was a real sort of French, English style, you know, push, 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 hours, hours, hours. I sort of learned how to do that there.
The graft,
yeah. And then at Mike, he taught me how to think about ingredients, think outside the square, you know, be innovative. So I always think back to, those two restaurants definitely helped form my...
I look at it from the outside. I spent a little bit of time in Auckland, not a long time, but, you know, the likes of Meredith, actually probably Meredith stands out more and Sid's taken it from there, but of the kind of that base level of what New Zealand cuisine is now, like there was a real introduction and movement at that time. There was people willing to go out and do something different. Like, you know, Mike's food was very different. It was, you could see a picture and know it was his.
Yeah.
You know, it was more definition to a style of cuisine for a particular restaurant that would have been going around. Well, it must have been an exciting environment to be in.
Yeah, no, it was good.
Get that going.
Yeah.
And from there, is that when you went over to San Fran?
I got my first head chef job at a place called Tribeca.
Yeah.
In New Zealand, you can become a head chef at a young age.
Crazy.
It's crazy and it can be good, but then it can also be bad.
Yeah.
But I think it's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, I had a good base level of people that I'd learned from. Because it's going to take you 5 years to figure out what type of chef you want to be anyway.
That's true.
So I did Tribeca for 2 years and that was awesome. You know, the boss was, he believed in me and gave me everything that I needed to do to succeed. It wasn't like a super busy restaurant, but we had, you know, we had awesome reviews. It was a good first platform for me. And then after Tribeca, I went to the Waiheke Island Yacht Club. That was in San Francisco.
With Tribeca there, was there a difference in that place in it that it wasn't a chef owner? Rather than coming through the ranks under someone that was a chef, but actually feeling the freedom of you are the chef, you know, you've got that freedom. Was that important?
Yeah, it was important that the owner let me like find myself, you know, and find the food. He really supported me. Yeah. Mark, he's this American guy. He's crazy. In hindsight, he's real. And we had a falling out when I left.
Yeah,
I think it's just because I left. He was just pissed off that I left. But he gave me the freedom to do it. And you know, I talk to a lot of younger chefs or sous chefs, and they're like, "Oh, I want to be a head chef. I want to be a head chef." And there's not many of the right head chef jobs out there. You could go into a head chef role where you're a head chef, but you're not really a head chef. You're sort of really constrained with what you can do. So, yeah, I always just remember getting offered the job. You know that when you go from like a sous chef to a head chef somewhere and the pay rise can be like, it was like $25,000 pay rise. I remember sitting in my car just being like, oh. Like,
here we go.
Lifestyle. Yeah, yeah. I was reading the other day that there's only a few times in your life that will actually happen.
Yep.
That you'll have a real big jump in income.
Mm.
And I remember, I'm not really driven by money, but it felt
it's
good.
Exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It does really fascinate me that step up. I mean, I got my first head chef job at 21 in a 43-seat restaurant that would average 100 covers a night. And it was busy. And I was the youngest in the kitchen and running people. And I had to learn really quick to be so much better than I was even the day before.
Yeah.
Because I had to keep that going. Otherwise, the team just wouldn't follow.
And I think it makes you a good leader, though, in hindsight. You know, you're just saying that when you're leading that first head chef job and you've got people older than you above you, you have to learn how to be a man manager or a people manager. Quickly. You can't just be one way because they're going to – it's interesting because you have to figure out, okay, well, I'm younger than this guy or girl.
Yeah.
And how am I going to get them to work for me?
It is interesting. And I use similar skills now with multiple venues hiring head chefs because you have to let them go and do their thing and have ownership.
Yeah.
But also picking and choosing and how to edit that and let that work in a way that's going to go forward. And I feel that's the same as a head chef role where the more you get your staff doing, you know, and using their skills and knowledge and you harness that skills and knowledge as well as adding to it, you know, that's a real skill in getting the most out of people.
Yeah, 100%.
And, yeah, I think the same way from an ownership point of view now.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you want your leaders to be able to lead. So you've got to back them up as opposed to.
Absolutely. So it's like a sports mentality of coaching, you know. Like
absolutely.
I love, you know, the best coaches in the world and you hear them talk about that, you know. It's when you're just a head chef, you might be just a captain, really.
Yeah.
And then when you become an owner, you're a coach.
Yeah.
And it's like, how do I get the best out of my captain and my players? And
And get over yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
Let other
you just realize
it's
not about you anymore. Yeah. It's about the team, right?
That's it. A little bit distracted there. So yeah, you mentioned the Waiheke Yacht Club in San Fran.
Yeah.
What was that all about, and how did that come about?
Des Harris, who I think is at the Hunting Lodge now, he was the head chef at Clooney, and they were actually going to open another restaurant called the Hamptons. And then Des was sort of going to go to an exec role, and he had asked me if I was interested in being the head chef at Clooney, which I was, because at the time it was a really, shit hot restaurant, and I was like, man, that will be a huge step up for me. And so that was the plan. And then literally, like, I think we went to like a cheese tasting, and I saw him there, because we were just in talks, and he's like, yeah, you're not coming to Clooney. And I was like, oh, what? And he's like, nah, what about San Francisco? And I was like, absolutely. And so the yacht club was, it was Tony Stewart's brainchild, really. Mm-hmm. Basically a New Zealand pop-up restaurant for the America's Cup in San Francisco on the Embarcadero. Because I've never worked overseas. I had never worked overseas. I'd never done that OE. You know, like you'd said, you worked a Michelin star restaurant. I always thought that was sort of like a slight on me. I was like, God, bugger. But when I got the opportunity to head chef a restaurant, even though a pop-up, but it was like a full-on restaurant in San Francisco, it was just like a dream come true. So
cool.
It was 200 seats, lunch, brunch, dinner, 7 days a week. Yeah, no, it was intense, but it was amazing. It was absolutely, like, it was probably one of the best times of my career.
And the team, staff-wise, and that, was that locals, as in San Fran locals, or was that a whole lot of Kiwis? What was the deal there?
I had like four sous chefs. Two of them bought with us, and then two that we hired there.
Okay,
and then so it was probably like a third of the staff were Kiwis, and then two thirds American.
And the culture difference of, you know, kitchens over there.
Yeah, it's way different.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the level of that we were hiring at wasn't like a 2-3 mission. You know, the chefs weren't coming from the French Laundry or anything. They were more like your line cooks, you know, with the bandana, and they were just like, but still.
The pirate crew.
Yeah, the pirate crew, but still amazing chefs, you know, like the culture was, it's hard to explain. America's pretty, I thought then it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Now I don't know so much.
Yeah, I just think that American model of kitchens, it is very unique, you know, it is very different, and there's almost more, I've found more structure to what your particular role is in a kitchen, and maybe it's the size of brigades, and that seems to be a big difference. And so I was wondering what was that like from, someone who hasn't worked overseas before to being introduced to leading a whole new culture of chefs?
You know, we hired two American sous chefs, and I took a lot of lead from them. It was just even terms like 86. You know, I was like, what are they talking about? And they're like, we don't have 86 portions left of that. It's like, there's none. And they're like, yeah, chef, 86, man, it's gone. It was a mindfuck completely. Because, you know, you've got at-will employment over there, so you can fire people on the spot. Mm-hmm. And then you've also got chefs that are like, I've worked 8 hours, like, where's my two breaks? Even though, like, we do that now, but I've never seen it, like, where's my break, putting my knives down, I'll walk out type thing.
And so from there?
So from there we came home.
Yeah.
And we worked for the Hip Group,
yep,
which was like a big cafe conglomerate, I'd probably put it down to. They were like sort of the hottest thing in Auckland as far as sort of daytime eateries go.
Yeah.
I'd probably say still are. You know, they've got Amano, Ortolana, Milsay, you know, they did have St. Helier's Bay Bistro, all of those. And, you know, as business models, they were fantastic.
Mm.
And we were going to take over Provenance, which was sort of where where the farm was.
Yeah.
And then so I was working, while all of that was happening, I was sort of working at St. Helier's Bay Bistro and Rosie, Provenance. And it was like I'd never worked in cafes before. And it was sort of like, It was it was hard for me because these places are it's a lot of bodies. There's a lot of money, and I just didn't. I guess I wasn't as flexible. I don't know. I was still just pretty hardcore with where I wanted my standards to be. As far as I was concerned, it should still be perfect every single time, no matter how many people you do. But it's sort of, I think in that case, it's maybe not their priority.
Or balance. Or, you know. It's maybe lowering the difficulty so you can do it 100% every time.
You know, with groups, you have, you know, like the hip group, had like Joe Pearson's the executive chef, and she's amazing at what she does. She's such an awesome chef. But, you know, you'd need 10 clones of her in each single place. Yeah, like I couldn't do what she does.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just, we found it quite difficult, you know, like we found it, and Provenance was going to sort of extend a little bit too far out of, and I guess we just didn't see it in the end. And so we stayed for like 7 months, and then we were a little bit sort of disheartened with the opportunities in New Zealand. You know, I'd sort of worked at all the restaurants I'd wanted to work. There was no good head chef jobs going. Like there were some going, but it was sort of like with a group. Yeah. And then the group, you know, unless it's a head chef who's like, who's been a chef, who's heading that group, it's always going to be sort of like a numbers game first.
Yeah.
And so then we just wanted to, we're still young enough, we wanted to immerse ourselves in that dining scene we saw in San Francisco, which is incredible. You know, like you just, the standard and the quality of restaurants and food was just phenomenal. And so we thought, oh, let's go to Melbourne. And it's just, So we just decided on my wife's birthday, we went for a walk and she's like, yeah, let's just go. So we just moved to Melbourne and just for new opportunities. Yeah.
Cool. And you worked around in Melbourne a little bit before Etta?
I got a job at a head chef job, which was, and again, I was lucky. My friend Morgan McGlone, he hooked me up with his friend Darren, and Darren and his wife, Alona, were opening a restaurant in Carlton. And this was like an old pub that was called Percy's, and it's like Percy was this AFL like legend.
Yeah.
But like when I turned up, the place was a dive, but you know, they were going to do it all up and they needed a head chef and sort of and Darren was, again, he was super keen to sort of go with whatever as long as the food was super tasty.
Yeah.
And there, he called it the Roving Marrow, which is like one of the most bizarre names I've ever heard for a restaurant. I don't even know what we're thinking. I'm pretty sure I was like, yeah, man, that's awesome. And the concept, which is we were going to do like the guys at Culprit, like Kyle and Jordan are doing, was like a European yamcha. And because I'd seen it at State Bird Provisions. Yep. And I thought that it was just such a cool idea, but it was just a hard concept. I think at State Bird they can do it because they've got literally 50 people waiting outside their restaurant every single day. So they sit down at once and it's like a yum cha. It's like Dragons, you know, you couldn't do Dragons if it was only 30 or 40 people.
Need the volume. Yeah.
So you need the volume and you need it to be, you need the demand as well.
And the buy-in from staff of how to, the confidence in doing that. I mean, I remember eating at Culprit early days and I could see the food. I could see how it was going to work. I could see the confidence from the food, but the staff still were not confident enough to just offer you food.
Yeah.
There was an explanation. Oh, this is how we do it, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And it took away a little bit from the vibe. Because the one thing about Yumcha is even if you've never been there, you're expected to know how it works.
Yeah.
You know? And that's just part of it. It is what it is.
100%.
So I think that is a huge sort of step with that, is breaking that barrier and the expectations of customers with Western-style food as opposed to, you know, a traditional Yumcha.
Yeah.
Breaking that down.
Yeah, it was a challenging time. And then we sort of scrapped it after 3 months and just went to just a normal sort of sharing a la carte format.
Yeah.
And that was, it was easier, it worked better. It was good to try, you know, and people liked it that got it. But, yeah, it was I wouldn't say it was a success.
But
I was there for a year and then I decided that we wanted to do our own our own thing. And then, and that's how we came. I met Hannah Green, who was my old business partner.
Yep.
She worked with my wife, Dom, at Rosetta. Yeah, we were both in the right place at the right time. We both wanted the same thing. And then we just started talking about doing a restaurant together.
Cool. And that experience, I mean, first restaurant, becoming an owner, all that sort of stuff. I mean, I think it doesn't hit you for probably 6 months that you're actually the owner of a place rather than just working for it. How did that go for you? And I mean that from not from a chef perspective, from a personal perspective. What was it like opening a restaurant for the first time?
Yeah, it was stressful, but I was up for the challenge, eh? I thought it was just awesome. You know, it was your time has come basically to do what you always wanted to do. Mm. Yeah, but then the realization that even though you think you're doing what you want to do, once you sort of have a concept and then you have an area and you have regulars and you sort of have a lane, then you basically have to stick within that anyway. Yeah. So it's not just like, you know, you get to
do whatever you want whenever you want.
Do whatever you want whenever you want. Yeah. So, well, in the first week that we opened, we found out we're pregnant. So that was like I remember stressing out about being ready to open and like finishing everything. And then, you know, we got the pregnancy test and it was positive. And I remember just thinking, oh, like it is going to be fucking easy compared to being a parent.
Yeah.
You know, so it actually took a lot of pressure off it.
Yeah, cool.
And you know, and we opened and it was awesome, man. Like we were really busy, you know, again, great reviews. We had great response from the general public. The locals loved it.
Yeah.
And saying that, like, it was really hard because once Sasha came along, you know, Edda was, I'd have Monday, Tuesday off.
Yeah.
And then my wife would work Monday to Friday,
mm.
you know, so and Edda was mainly nights. So it was, it got to a point, and I'd always seen other chefs go down that path of just focusing, like being a chef or owning their restaurant was the most important thing.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they wouldn't say it is, but their actions would sort of speak louder than words, you know. And so, you know, I wanted to, being a parent, like being a father and then being a husband is more important than my career. And being an only child for ages, that was just no way, man. My career was everything to me. But then, you know, life changes.
It does.
And then you could see pretty quickly that, you know, there was going to be a lot of sacrifices, you know, for me to keep it, to try and be a good dad, good husband. And then you're just not being good in yourself once all those things are piling up. Do you know what I mean?
Like
the pressure of it all.
Yeah. I mean, I understand completely where you're coming from and that transition from chef is what you do as opposed to who you are.
Mm.
You know, there's that change and the focus being on other people. And I don't know about you, but for me, within that, there's also that risk of forgetting about yourself.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're worrying about the business and staff and all sorts of things like that. And then you're worrying about your partner and all those sort of things.
Yeah.
What about you?
Yeah, yeah.
And until you can get that as part of the balance as well, it really kind of nothing works.
Yeah. I'm only just figuring that out now. You know, like, and I think it's an ongoing thing to figure out, right? You know, but also, you know, we'd spent a lot of money on getting Edda up and running. Like, so like we'd put a lot of capital into it. You know, my parents had lent me money. Hannah's parents had lent her money. Mm. We had money from the bank. You know, it was nearly like 650K all up. And then I just saw, by the time I saw any return on investment and sort of being able to, I don't know, be financially secure, was going to be like 10, 15 years down the track basically. And then so we just decided that, you know, we wanted to sort of leave Edda.
Yeah.
And it was hard because, you know, we didn't really get anything. You know, I basically gave my half to Hannah.
Yeah.
And then I took my parents' debt with us. So, you know, every day we pay, every week we pay off that. It's nearly $180,000, man. But, you know, like you read those, or you watch those stories of these chefs that have these just like humbling experiences. And I feel like I've had mine now.
Hopefully.
No, but it was also, I've learned so much from that.
Yeah.
Like to go and open up another business now, there's just like, even just from the financials of, you know, how much money do I spend? It's like, well, figure out what your rent is. And then if that's going to be a percentage of that, then your return is going to be in 2 or 3 years. And you figure out that, and is that going to align with your concept? Does that concept align with you?
Yeah.
But you have to go through these.
You do. And there's no other way to learn. I mean, value is one of the things that I work with a lot.
Mm.
Right. What is value? And that can be something that's a dollar, can be expensive, at a dollar. Something that's $1,000 can be cheap at $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a philosophy I learned, I don't know where, but carried through. We have never spent a lot of money on restaurants.
Yeah.
But they pay for their self-improvement over time.
Yeah.
And that's that story that you're saying. I was always really scared of that, of that putting a whole lot in at the start and waiting for that return.
Yeah.
You know, and not that I'm not particularly financially driven when it comes to the restaurants. There's lots of other things we want to achieve with them.
Yeah.
But they do pay for themselves.
Yeah.
And Hillside's a perfect example from what it was 5 years ago to what it is today. Everything that's happened there, it's paid for itself.
Yeah. No, that's wicked.
You know, and I think that is like a $10,000 marble bar to me.
Yeah.
Is not worth anything. It's bad value.
Even, you know, when we're going through this, I remember thinking like, maybe being in Melbourne, didn't really have any sort of like mentors to sit me down and be like, bro, you don't need that.
Yeah.
The customers just want your cooking and awesome service. And like the best places that you can go sometimes are, you can tell that people have just gotten a slight lick of paint.
Yeah.
And it's delicious.
Exactly.
And the wine's awesome. The service is great. And then you're just thinking like, oh man, I bet you they're not stressing out about, you know, paying back all this money. But it's one of those things I had to go through to learn. Yeah. I like to say it was like a really expensive MBA that I got there.
Oh, it's an education, that's for sure.
Yeah.
No, I think that's really interesting. I'm glad that you brought that up because I think it is something that, that value proposition of owning a restaurant and what it can be and the pressure it can put on you is pretty significant. And,
absolutely.
And maybe not enough people come through HOSPO with the definition of business.
Yeah.
It's more about the restaurant than the business.
And, you know, and then young head chefs, you know, they sort of say, oh, you know, I want my own place or I feel like, you know, like after it happened, I remember thinking like we need to write all this stuff down, you know, so there's a resource for people, young restaurateurs to go to, to you know, explain in black and white. Not everyone, you know, likes to share their secret sauce.
Yeah.
But then maybe, you know, maybe that was me. Maybe I should have just been more proactive and asked more questions of people.
Well, we just don't get it. As a chef, chefs are in the kitchen. They're so focused on plates of food and things like that that you don't see the outside.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the real dangers. Yeah. The other day when Lotto was 40 million or whatever it was, I was like, if I win Lotto, I'm going to open a restaurant incubator. You know, like a situation where people with an idea can come and operate for 3 months and find out what operating a restaurant actually is.
Yep.
And with a classroom that suppliers and restaurateurs go and speak to and all that sort of stuff. Like,
yeah.
Something like that, I think the industry, it would change the industry for
100%
a long, long time.
And one for service too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, the whole package.
Just everything.
Yeah, the whole package.
Just make it all, we just need to all be better. So.
Yeah, exactly. And, and from all walks. So, yeah, going back to what you're talking about there, I mean, it is something that fascinates me. Your wife is in HOSPO as well.
Yeah.
Working together for years or working in the industry for years with the antisocial hours, all those sort of things, and then bringing a kid into that as well. How have you guys worked through that? Like, how have you survived?
Well, Dom had to, she had to leave the game.
Yeah.
You know, she's like a multi-talented person. She was a lawyer, then got a degree in journalism, and then just so happened to sort of like, you know, wait tables at Depot. And then I think she was working for Gather and Hunt. And then Michael Meredith was over for dinner and just loved, you know, getting on with Dom. And then I don't even know. And then he rang like next week and was like, does she want to be the restaurant manager at Meredith's? She's just got that thing that you can't teach people.
Mm.
I think, I don't want to say that women make better hosts, but they've got that, it's like built-in mother, caring, hospitable.
Whether it's nature or nurture.
Yeah. It's something it like that. Thing. I've got lots of, you know, guy mates out there that also host, but I'm not saying better. It's something that can't be taught.
Yeah.
So she got into writing creative at radio station, a big radio station in Melbourne. But before that, she opened Marion, which was Andrew McConnell's restaurant, and then went over to Cutler & Co., which was his fine dining restaurant. But that was before Sasha was born.
Yeah.
So we've only worked together really this year.
Okay.
With Sasha in the mix because she's 2.5 now.
Yeah.
We're lucky because Dom's mum lives with us.
Okay.
Yeah. I never thought, you know, living with my mother-in-law would be awesome, but it absolutely is. She's a blessing. Like, we don't know how we could do it. in a way, I sort of think it would mean more like structure. Then when you there's a good thing when you have a kid in the in hospitality, you know, like I don't know how we could get a nanny or stuff. I wouldn't want to, but we're lucky it flows because it's breakfast, lunch, and dinner 7 days a week.
Yeah.
Okay, so Dom could do days, or I could do days, and she could do nights. So we've got flexibility, you know, to be able to do it.
Yeah,
and that was one of the biggest things, or one of the best things about coming here and coming to Floridita's is the flexibility. And I can't see myself, like I won't go and work in a nighttime only restaurant again.
Yeah.
Like it's just, and that's just from a family perspective. But also not even just that, just general, like you talk about looking after yourself. I've never looked after myself as much as I am now.
That culture is changing, fortunately. Just needs to change faster.
Yeah.
One thing that I'm really interested in, and I hope I'm not presuming too much here, but I think the you transitioning into Flo's story comes into this, is restaurant succession planning.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is something you don't see a whole lot of it in New Zealand. You know, there's a few family-owned restaurants that have been passed down.
Yeah.
French Cafe has done it a couple of times
in
my memory now. But that idea of, you know, an established restaurant passing on to new people, or that process. So firstly, how did you end up the Flo's discussion, and where did that come from? And if you want to talk about the setup and that would be really great.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, just about that idea of succession, keeping a business. So the business stays, but the owners are handed over to an extent.
Yeah, yeah. So I actually did a talk for Restaurant Association like 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And Julie was in the crowd.
Yeah.
And then she came up to me afterwards and she you know, in her funny way, she was like, oh, I hope you don't mind I'm stalking you, but I just really liked your chat. And we're coming to Melbourne next week just by chance. So we'll come in together and see you. And so the following week they came and had a really awesome meal. Well, I think so. And then I didn't hear from Julie for maybe 6 months. And then Wally on a Plate was happening the following year. So she emailed me in March and said, look, they're doing these takeovers now. You know, would you be interested in Edda coming to Flo's and doing a takeover?
Mm.
And I was like, absolutely. That'd be so cool. And I still hadn't really... I hadn't heard of Floridita's before, you know, knowing that Floridita's is an institution in Wellington, it's sort of in Auckland, you sort of have your blinkers on to the rest of the country. So we came over and we had an awesome time.
Mm.
And like James and Julie have got like a wealth of knowledge. I started to sort of, you know, ask questions about, you know, because they're obviously successful restaurateurs, like not just once, but like seven, eight times over, you know, and so I'd wanted a mentor, like a business mentors like that. And they were super honest and would just tell us everything basically, like, you know, what happens and, you know, doesn't just happen overnight and you got to work hard, all of that stuff. And I remember when we got on the plane to go back, I said, oh, I don't think that'll be the last time we do something with them.
Yeah.
And then I'd sort of left Edda and we're planning to come home. And so I took a head chef job at a place called Neptune, which was just shitty. And it was a good place, but it was in Windsor in Melbourne. And, you know, there'd be like 20 people lined up on a Friday night just to go do the bag in the toilets. Yep. And it was just, I'd never been around that. Like that. I was like, this is not me, you know. And she'd sort of, you know, I'd bleated along to her in a few emails and stuff. And then she said, oh, look, we're coming over and we've got a proposal for you.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, okay, cool. You know, so she came over and she said, you know, well, the whole thing, we're looking for a bit of a succession plan. And Julie had hatched the idea. And she basically just said that she believed in me and my cooking and she didn't want to see it go to waste. You know, like after Edda, am I just going to be a chef my whole life? You know, like I thought maybe there's something else that I want to do, you know, that I could be good at.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'd watch like Chef's Table and, you know, Delicious, the Netflix stuff. Yeah. And then I'd just be like, fuck this, man. Like I really love cooking. Like it just gets me going, right? So I think sometimes you just need some people to believe in you. And she believed in me. And I said, look, we'll definitely consider it, but we'll come as a package deal. Like if I'm coming, Dom would be coming as well. And she was like, yeah, like because they were sort of like, they didn't know much about Dom. But then after they had sort of learnt about everything that Dom had done, it was like, yeah, absolutely. And now we just couldn't imagine just me coming on board. Yeah. And so, yeah, and we wanted to come home. We'd thought about where would we go back, and it sort of settled on Auckland because we know people there.
Yeah.
But then I was sort of like, neither of us really wanted to go back to Auckland, and we'd never been to lived in Wellington, and we wanted that sense of adventure.
Mm.
Like we got in San Fran, like we got in Melbourne, and you know, like and Wellington's got that.
Yeah,
it's new, it's fresh. There's new people. We're meeting people. It's got a really cool hospitality dining vibe.
Yeah, Wellington's in a really unique space at the moment as well.
Yeah.
It really is. This is the longest I've lived anywhere, like my whole life. And it's kind of happened accidentally.
Okay.
I've been here 7-8 years.
Yeah.
And seen the evolution of Wellington even in that time and comparing it to places where I've lived overseas, I think, you know, Wellington's an incredibly exciting place.
Yeah.
But also there are people like Julie. I haven't had that much interaction.
Yeah.
But I'm so inspired by her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, you just can't not be, I don't think.
No.
But there's the institutions that are willing to give and promote what's coming through.
Yeah.
And what's coming through is exciting and is pushing. And there is a certain level of Wellington tribalism as well.
Yeah.
You know, there's a real pride of being Wellington.
Yeah.
Which I think is really exciting.
Mm.
And if it can attract people like yourself, you know, you've done a lot. You've already offered so much to the industry. So if it's drawing people like you in, that says something too.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's great.
Like, I definitely think that there's a lot happening in Wellington. I think that, I feel like there were better restaurants in Auckland 5 years ago.
Mm.
You know, like I think when Simon and Cragen left the French Cafe, that was a huge dent. Yep. Like they were amazing restaurateurs.
Mm.
And Mike hasn't been in the game for a while. You know, Tony's, you know, they've sold Clooney. It could be a sign of the times.
Yeah.
With change, but insane. Like I don't. You also need those few restaurants that are going to, like Ed at Pasture, he's sort of pushing the boat out, which is really good to see.
Yeah. I think it's just an evolution.
Yeah.
As Auckland's spread, the dining scene has got to spread a little bit more.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's no doubting that Pasture's incredible. I'm hearing amazing things about Forest.
Yeah.
From a completely different sort of perspective. But,
yeah.
You know, the stronger immigrant ethnic dining experience and quality of those restaurants coming through, I think, is really starting to show itself. The quality of the more casual dining at the moment, which I think is only going to feed a future of really interesting high-end dining in Auckland.
Yeah.
And you do get these waves and changes and all that sort of stuff. But I think the spread of population is probably what's affected the high-profile restaurants more than anything else.
Yeah. I like how Wellington's so tight. Like demographically, all the restaurants are quite close together, which we really enjoy.
Yeah. So just to finish things up, really, I mean, we've kind of talked about you as a chef, but a bit more as a chef, how do you see food? Like what's your driving sort of factor when you think about a menu or dishes and things like that?
I think it changes every year in a way. You know, like I'll have a dish from last year, which was amazing. And then you try to do the same dish. You don't want to do the same dish, but you might do the same dish, but it never tastes the same. Yeah. It's like your palate evolves. I'm probably more focused now on creating food that is within, so like Floriditas at the moment, what does that look like? What are the clientele? What do they think Floriditas is and what that feels like?
Yeah.
So trying to keep within that realm.
Speak that language.
Speak that language, yeah. It's really important. I don't mean to sound sort of stereotype, but it really all comes down to the produce, which is easy to forget.
Yeah.
Like I think it was just like 2 weeks ago, I was trying to work on something and I was working with something that wasn't like, maybe it was, I think it was pumpkin and it just wasn't tasting good. And then Julie was like, oh, why are you using pumpkin? That's not good at this time of year. And I was like, oh, and like in Victoria, it's sort of good all year round. So learning about the ingredients again in New Zealand. But then even just in saying that, I was just like, oh, you're completely right. You know, like pumpkin's shit at the moment.
Yeah.
Like what's really good at the moment? Okay, fennel. You know, like Swedes are really good at the moment. Okay, so then I'll use that as a, for, say we've got this new like lamb shoulder. If it's like a protein based, I'll start with the protein and then pair it with something that's really in season. And then if it's vegetarian, it'll all just come from what's perfect in season right then, which is actually easier said than done.
It is.
Because right now there's nothing that's really perfectly in season.
No, we're coming into the hunger gap, which is...
Yeah, asparagus is about to come on, but it won't be good for like a month or so. But I've already got ideas for those things, and then globe artichokes, and then peas, and then it just starts to snowball to heaps of amazing seasonal ingredients. I like making vegetables taste awesome. Like if you can't cook a piece of fish properly, then there's sort of, as a chef, there's something wrong with you. Yeah. People might only have a certain level of expectation for a cabbage, and if you can do things to that cabbage that people walk out and they're like, I just never knew it could taste that good. Yeah. To me, that's what it's all about.
Yeah, it's almost that idea of underselling and over-delivering.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, a lot easier to do with a vegetable or, yeah, something that's not seen as such a normal focal point of a meal.
Yeah.
No, that's cool. Hey, is there anything else on your mind that you'd like to spout out?
It'll be interesting with COVID. You know, like since coming back to New Zealand, there are good restaurants, but I think there's just so many shit ones.
Mm-hmm.
I know this sounds really bad. I think it's the same everywhere. But I'm hoping that, I don't want to hope that people close, but I do hope that just more good ones stay around and are sort of celebrated a little bit more.
I think that comes back to that value proposition I was talking about earlier. And maybe people have realized that a little bit. There's tons of restaurants. And, you know, like one thing we get a lot with the ramen shop is, oh, but this place does $8 noodles. You know, why are yours 15? It's like, we make them from scratch.
Yeah.
Free range ingredients, you know, good veggies, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Made from scratch. It doesn't come out of a box, doesn't come out of a freezer. And I think with, the COVID factor could actually help with that, where people actually want to know that story. And if you're being a bit more careful with your money, if we can convince people better where the value is in quality and, you know, it is okay to spend $50 on something that's really good.
Yes.
As opposed to $30 on something that's really shit. The $50 is better value.
Yeah, 100%.
And that's where I think that's come through. And the message that came out throughout this COVID process of supporting your local, really getting to know your restaurants and how maybe bad the hospitality industry has been, from a business model perspective, it is a chance to refresh and change. So while we might have some restaurants that aren't great, I think that's been slightly consumer driven.
Yeah.
And so if that mindset changes,
yeah,
rather than losing whole restaurants, we can have more better restaurants.
Yeah, 100%. When the whole thing went down, I was thinking, well, we just need to cut all the fluff, all the fuzz, all the shit out of everything that we do, and it just needs to be like a distilled part of hospitality. The food needs to be like really delicious, you know, seasonal. The service needs to be really good. The value needs to be like clear and concise. It just has to be. So that's what we've been focusing on more, is just making sure that what we do is just sort of better every single day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that focus. Focus in general is just such an important thing. And it's one thing we've definitely learned more and more. Every year we offer less and we offer it better.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I've cut the menus in half in the day and the night, and it's been great.
Yeah. Nah, cool. Hey, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and chat to us. It's much appreciated.
Awesome, man. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time to listen to us today. Check out honeycomb.co.nz for information and links relating to this episode. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast so you'll never miss an episode.